We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 124.
On today's show, we talk about obsidian flakes in Lake Huron, a wheelbark cemetery in Poland, and a computer program sorting pottery in the Southwest.
Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show. Rachel, how's it going?
Good.
So, yet once again, we have birds in the background. And they're not even in the room we're in.
Me too. I know. They're really, really loud out there. Yeah. There's like a tree right outside the window and they're just, you know,
I know,
singing their songs.
I know. We're in like a two-room condo or something or other. Once a year kind of thing for us. Mm-hmm. And the doors open in the other room and I can hear those birds like they're right here. I don't know if the audience can hear those, but totally crazy. Anyway, speaking of flight risks, we're going to talk about... obsidian.
I don't think that's
launching its way across the continent. Yeah. Like a bird in flight.
Wow, that's not how I interpreted this article, but hey, to each his own. So the name of this article is Central Oregon Obsidian from a Submerged Early Holocene Archaeological Site Beneath Lake Huron. So this was published in the PLOS One Journal. And it was just recently published, I think just May 19th or something like that, just a few days ago. And it really caught my eye when I was trying to find cool, interesting topics for us, because we have mostly worked out here on the West Coast in Nevada and some in California. And obsidian is common on the landscape here. Yeah. It's cool and interesting to see it, but it's very common and we don't think anything of it. But mm-hmm. This is very different and very interesting because there is no natural obsidian that far east. So it was very unusual for them to find this. And then they did some more research to figure out where it came from and what was going on there. So this article is really neat.
Why isn't there obsidian on the East Coast?
Oh, I don't know. Geologically speaking, yeah. I mean, it's volcanically formed. So I suppose it would be the lack of mountains.
Well, there are mountains. They're just really, really old mountains. They're way older than the mountains we have here. The big jagged mountains that we have in the West, like the Rockies and the Sierras. Uh-huh. And, you know, the Pacific coast of this continent is part of what's called the Ring of Fire. That mm-hmm. goes all the way over Japan and all the way around. That's right. What Hawaii is formed from, you know, the volcanoes in Alaska, everything. So volcanoes spit out obsidian like it's their job.
Right.
And that's where you get it. And then it hardens as glass, mm-hmm. basically, because it's essentially, you know, sand-like material. It's silica-based. No, it's not silica-based. Yeah, I think it is.
I think you're right, because sand is.
Because it basically does turn into glass.
Yeah.
So anyway... there probably is obsidian on the East Coast, but it's, you know, 1,000 feet underground.
Oh, true. You know? Yeah.
I mean, those volcanoes, those mountain ranges, I don't know if they were volcanically formed, but like the Appalachians, the Adirondacks, all those mountains over there, but they're so old and worn down and small and they're just, there's nothing left of them anymore. But I don't know how they were found. Were they just uplift or were they volcanically created like a lot of the mountains over here? I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I'm not really sure either. But I would speculate that they were not volcanically formed just because of the lack of obsidian. You'd find some somewhere.
You would think,
a cut from a river or something would have some.
Well, with uplift, too, it would, even if it was way low, it would be brought up high. So,
yeah, we need a geologist right now to set us straight. But
all I know is we still have active volcanoes over here on this coast.
Yes.
And we have volcanoes that were active not that long ago.
Yes.
And we have obsidian that... you know, dates back a long ways, but also dates back to not too far away either.
Yeah.
Right.
So, geologically speaking.
Yeah. Either way, it's in abundance. We've been to a place called Glass Mountain.
Yeah.
In Northern California.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, it's called Glass Mountain because it's literally a mountain of obsidian.
Yeah.
You know, and the BLM, I think, owns it. And we know people that have gone there and collected obsidian as a source. And I think it's something like they limit you to like 50 pounds a day or something.
Yeah.
And there's still plenty.
Because there's so much of it. Yeah. And it comes in all kinds of colors and banding. Yeah. And there's so many different things, which actually will come into play with this article because the the obsidians can look so different, and there's also a chemical difference going on. Mm-hmm. They can test it to figure out where it comes from. And they do that for this article. But before we get there, just a quick thing about obsidian. Like we said, it's on the West Coast. They do have some sources that are as far east as like South Dakota, Wyoming-ish area. Yeah. But that's about as far east as source material goes. So the fact that they found these flakes in an archaeological site beneath Lake Huron tells you that they got there by people rather than by natural processes. So that's, and also they're flakes, so they're, you know, man-made. But, you know, the reason that they're there is because people brought them there, which is mm-hmm. what grabbed my attention. I thought that was really cool to see that movement of a really special material across the country like that. And if you're wondering about the archaeological site being submerged beneath Lake Huron, yeah. they didn't actually put a lot about that in the article because that wasn't really the main focus. But I guess the lake level was much lower in the Holocene time period. So there's archaeological sites underneath a lot of Lake Huron, like all yeah. around the edges that were exposed back then. So that's why. And I guess they must have done some kind of underwater archaeology to get down there and excavate this stuff, which to see that methodology would be really cool too, but they don't really go into it much in this article.
Yeah, I don't know the cycle very much, but I'm pretty sure the Great Lakes themselves were etched, carved out by glaciers, but not yeah. just the last glacial maximum. I mean, glaciers advance and recede every, I think it's 25,000 years or something like that, mm-hmm. give or take. And the last receding? I don't know. The last retreat.
I don't know,
glacial
actually.
Retreat.
There you go.
Yeah. The last retreat happened, you know, in the last 10 to 15,000 years.
Yeah.
And so as those glaciers were retreating, I mean, they held all the water. Right. It yeah. was frozen. They held all the water. So they would have pulled back on what would have already have been carved out, but now more carved out by these glaciers, the Great Lakes and a bunch of other stuff. This is why Minnesota has 10,000 lakes.
Right.
There's a bunch of just, you know, yeah. it's crazy.
Yep.
And then as the earth warmed, they would have melted and basically filled in all the lower spots. Mm-hmm. But before then, people were like, hey, this looks like a good place to be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. yeah. Look, it sounds like there's a lot of archaeological activity mm-hmm. there. So it must have been a really great fertile place to be. Well, so.
And that makes sense because the entire Midwest where all of our food is grown, mm-hmm. there's a lot of lust there, LOESS, which is the winds and stuff that blows sure. off the front of glaciers and things.
Yeah.
And it's just incredibly fertile soil.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, so that's how they, or that's why they were looking there. It's because they, you know, knew that there was a lot of archaeological sites underneath the lake, and they recovered two obsidian flakes. And those two flakes, they have conclusively dated them to about 9,000 years before present. And they are also conclusively sourced to Wagon Tire Obsidian in Central Oregon, which is a distance of over 4,000 kilometers away. And also, this makes it the furthest east occurrence of obsidian in the United States. So that's pretty cool.
I have a problem with wagon tire obsidian. Wagons didn't have tires. So.
Well, then you need to go talk to the people in Oregon who named their source mountains.
Wagon tire does not make any sense.
A little bit more about the flakes themselves that they found. They're the larger of the two. It's mostly complete. It was roughly triangular, and they speculate it's probably a biface thinning flake, and it's made from a black and translucent material.
So let's explain biface thinning flake for the audience real quick. So
please
biface
do.
Just means, if you picture an arrowhead, uh-huh. And we call them projectile points in the archaeological world, because arrowhead implies it was fired on an arrow, but it could have been a dart, it could have been a spear,
right.
It could have been a number of things, right? Well, really those three things, but variations on those three.
Yeah, and they can range in size and shape right. and everything, so arrowhead doesn't really work for all of them.
No, so when we want to be generic, we say projectile point, and
exactly.
we just kind of always say projectile point. Mm-hmm. And depending on where you're at, we will abbreviate that PPT, projectile point, or some
point.
Yeah, or some people say PPK, projectile point / knife.
Oh.
Because in some areas, some of the bigger points were possibly used as knife blades, stuff like that. So
right.
anyway, biface just means it was worked on both sides. There were flakes off of both sides because there are unifacial tools mm-hmm. that are just like a big flake. And then they took a bunch of stuff off one side to shape it.
Or get a sharp edge. And,
yeah, yeah. And they just kind of left it.
Yeah.
Right. But most things are bifacially worked. So a biface by calling it a biface and not a projectile point, we're kind of, I mean, a projectile point is inherently bifacial, but by calling it a biface, we usually mean it's an earlier stage mm-hmm. and unformed.
Yeah.
So it didn't have a usable shape. It had a preformed shape kind
right,
of thing.
Right. Yeah. It wasn't like meant to be a specific thing yet, but they were potentially working it
was
towards
a,
that.
It was a canvas waiting to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Waiting to be sculpted.
Yep. So the second flake that they found was a much smaller piece. And it's a very thin, very translucent obsidian. It's so small that it's likely a percussion flake. Now, a percussion flake is, it. If you can imagine, you need to resharpen the edge of the projectile point or the spear or whatever it is that you're trying to sharpen. You might take a tiny little flake off the edge just to help sharpen that edge. And mm-hmm. that's what they think that the second flake is. So those are the two they found. And they did X-ray fluorescence XRF analysis, and they sourced it to Central Oregon. They knew for sure it came from Central Oregon, but they didn't know exactly where. And this is what I thought was really cool, because I hadn't heard of this dating technique or this sourcing technique, but neutron activation analysis, NAA, that's where they test for additional elements that goes beyond what X-ray fluorescence does. And one of those elements is barium. And barium, there were three sources in Oregon that they thought it could be from, and the barium, the amount of barium at Wagon Tire perfectly matched the barium in the flakes that they found. And it was significantly different from the other source options. So that's how they were able to narrow it down to that one exactly, which I thought was really neat.
What did Native Americans do with their projectile points if they didn't want their enemies to find them? The barium.
Oh, no. You're so dumb. Hey, we did find a cache of projectile points one time. You remember that? In North Carolina?
The one that I found?
Yeah.
With my shovel?
No, there was definitely we happened.
That was my unit.
I know, but we. Come on. We worked on the same project.
Anyway, we can talk about that because it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
No, so both XRF and neutron activation analysis, what they do is they essentially stimulate the elements, or the electrons, for lack of a better way to say it, around the atoms that make these elements. Mm-hmm. And they, like in X-ray fluorescence, it actually fluoresces X-rays mm-hmm. and emits X-rays. And then you can read that. It's like when you put something into a flame and it has a color, you can tell what elements are in it. This is how we know what distant stars and planets are made of, mm-hmm. because we use a spectrometer to basically, you know, look in a really tiny dot in the sky and say, oh, it must be made of this.
Right.
Because it's true.
Yeah.
So anyway, both of those are designed. That's how they can tell the chemical fingerprint of it, because nothing in the ground is the same. Mm-hmm. All volcanoes might look the same when they're spewing hot lava, but that lava is very different from other hot lava.
Yeah. It's all made up of a very distinct set of elements, basically.
Yeah, because you can break this stuff down with the hotness of the lava, mm-hmm. but the elements are still there.
Yeah.
Like the atoms are still there. Mm-hmm. And then when it hardens, you can still detect these things.
Yep.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was really interesting to me, because we have worked on some projects where they were testing like the hydration sourcing, which mm-hmm. I think is a slightly different way of doing a similar thing, right?
Well, hydration isn't sourcing. Hydration is age. So,
So
obsidian hydration, this is where I was going to ask you, because you read this article about the dating, because they wouldn't have used these other two things for the dating. They would have used obsidian hydration for the dating, which is, for as far as I know, the only way you can date obsidian. But essentially, obsidian absorbs moisture from the air and develops this rind around the edge. And that's why when you see a piece of, if you've ever seen a piece of obsidian in the raw, it's very dull, mm-hmm. because the whole outside of it is a weathered rind. Yeah. Now, when you cut it up, when you smash
it, crack it open,
and then you take flakes off of something, they could probably even tell, oh, this would be really cool, because obsidian hydration dating is really hard to do, because you need to know what the environment is that the obsidian lived in, because mm-hmm. the hydration rates, the rate at which it absorbs moisture, is different here in the Great Basin, mm-hmm. where there's no moisture, versus Washington State, where there's a ton of moisture.
Right.
So the hydration rate is going to be massively different in different areas. So what I'd want to know, they found two flakes. Now, these flakes themselves, it'd be great if we had the tool. Because if you had the tool and then you had the flakes, you could see different rates of hydration. Mm-hmm. Because if the tool started somewhere else and then the flakes were taken off somewhere else, you know, that'd be one thing. But so if they dated the flakes to about 9,000 BP, it would be interesting to see what the tool would date to. It's basically the question.
Yeah, I don't know. They definitely didn't find the tool. They say in the article specifically that, yes, this material is exotic, but they want to point out that it was a relatively routine activity and that they don't think that it was part of anything special or anything ritual. And they definitely don't have the point that the flakes were taken off of. So they don't really know anything more than anything other than the fact that the obsidian got there somehow.
Right.
That's all they really know. And it does seem like it was probably like there's a social network of different bands of Native Americans who helped to pass this thing across the country too. It wasn't like one person from the upper Midwest went out to Oregon, got a bunch of obsidian and then went back. It was probably that it passed from group to group to group until it finally ended up where it was.
Yeah. And at some point when it passed from the West, from Oregon, I mean, Oregon is as far west as you can possibly get. So mm-hmm. when it passed from there and started getting into places that were where obsidian was more exotic, mm-hmm. it could have been seen as almost currency, you know, traded as something valuable and prized. Mm-hmm. But then who was the guy that was like, oh man, whatever this, I'm just going to sharpen it and then I'm going to use it. So
yeah, but like you have to, if it's dull and it's not doing its job anymore, if it was a knife or something, for example, something, a tool that would have been used repetitively rather than just a single time, you got to sharpen it.
But the thing about obsidian is it's difficult to use repetitively unless it's big, because obsidian is, I mean, you can't even say razor thin because it's thinner than a razor. Mm-hmm. It's up to, what do they say, like one electron wide or something like that, or one micron or something like, I don't know, the thickness of a human hair. It's super crazy sharp.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But it dulls really fast because of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, just imagine cutting something with glass. Sure, it cuts your skin real easy, but these guys are cutting hides. They're using it to you know, spear into animals or whatever size that the tool was. Mm-hmm. It breaks easy. I mean, it doesn't last long.
Well, so then a potential reason why they would have been flaking such a valuable resource is maybe it was a larger tool and they used it and it broke and they were mm-hmm. trying to take the broken pieces and turn them into something else usable. You know, that would be a reason for taking flakes off of something mm-hmm. that you otherwise wouldn't want to destroy. So just speculation though, of course. It's always speculation with archaeology.
Yeah, it shows the survival aspect of living in that area too, because such a material you would think would be highly exotic in the Lake Huron area. And I mean, if it's what you got and there's an animal there you got to kill, it's what you've got.
You
got
to eat, right?
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
I would have hated to be the person who was like taking the flakes off of that by face though, because I've only tried to nap obsidian one time mm-hmm. and it was challenging, like so challenging.
Yeah.
And I made the wonkiest, weirdly shaped biface, if you can even call it a biface, because I think I only got like maybe one or two flakes off of one of the sides. So like, well, it's hard.
And assuming this was traded for, again, that's a really good point, because how would the person who took these flakes off in Lake Huron even known how to do that? Now, it would have been similar techniques to like chert and stuff like that, but that's such a much more resilient material. You can put a lot more pressure on it mm-hmm. before you crack it in half. So I'm guessing they didn't find the tool because it was 40 feet away, because the guy was like, damn it, and just like chucked
it. Yeah.
So
probably. Anyway. So who knows though? That's interesting to think about.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's way too much time on this article, so we're going to take a break and head on to segment two. However, go over to the APN website, arcpodnet.com. We've revised our newsletter, and if you've ever been to the website, you know, I'll tell you what, it kind of gets me sometimes because I forget, but if you scroll up just a little ways on any page, you get a pop-up after a little while that says, join our newsletter. So just type your email address in there and you will get the next one. Mondays, we're sending out news articles like this, and Fridays, we're sending out basically a list with links to the podcast that released the last 7 days. So go check that out. We'll be back in segment two. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to Zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Welcome back to episode 124 of the Archaeology Show. And we are moving on to a new topic, other side of the world. We're going to Europe. And we're going to talk about a culture I'd never heard of before. And I'm going to say it, and I might be wrong. This would be the Wheelbark culture or Weilbark.
Where are they from?
They are, it's a German town.
Weilbark.
So maybe. Actually, it's in Poland.
Oh, well.
Yeah, maybe. Well, anyway.
Similar.
Yeah. So it's spelled Weilbark. And the reason that they are making the news is there's an article published in Antiquity about this culture. It's called The Goths, the Wheelbark Culture, and Over 100 Years of Research on the Eponymous Site. And they just, this article is really just like an overview of who they are, where they are, and why they're so important. And it caught my eye partly because it's a gigantic cemetery, like one of the biggest cemeteries in this time period in this place in Europe, number one. And number two, I just had never heard of it. And like, usually you hear about these larger cultures, you have heard of them at some point, but I hadn't, and I thought that was neat. So The cemetery is located near the town of Malbork, and then there's a small village called Wheelbark, which is where the name comes from, in northern Poland. Please excuse all my pronunciations. That's the last time I'm going to say that. And this culture is associated with the area from the southern coast of the Baltic Sea to the western part of Ukraine during the period between the beginning of the Roman period around the first century AD and then what they call the migration period, which is the fifth century AD. And that's when the Goths migrated into this part of Europe. So we have this sort of like hole in between Romans and Goth, and it's, well, we don't know a lot about them, but we have this cemetery full of people. So there's that.
So somehow they all died.
A lot of people died in 500 years. Go figure.
Like, welcome it happens. To any period in history.
Yeah. Welcome to always.
But cemetery, that's interesting, right?
Yeah. So there's more than 2,000 burials there. And like I said, it spans five centuries. And it's actually not like a huge area either. And they do have evidence that some of the earlier burials were basically chucked out of the way later on to make room for the later burials. So just a lot of burial activity going on in this cemetery over those 500 years that it was used. So some of the earlier burials were pre-Roman, and they are cremations that were in an urn that are buried in a pit. And a lot of those burials also had weapons with them. Then as we move forward in time, the cemetery was used, like most intensely actually used during this Roman period, from the third and fourth centuries. And those are primarily inhumations. And there's almost no weapons with these burials either. And interestingly, there's a kind of a rise in female grave goods. They get more complex and there's just more of them. And they're clearly like just, I don't know. They're
rising female grave goods.
Yeah. Like grave goods associated with women. Yeah. Just not even, they don't even say specifically what, just more of them and more things. Whereas before there wasn't necessarily any grave goods with female burials. So yeah.
Okay.
Interestingly, a large proportion of the vessels in the graves appear to be made specifically as cremation urns. Mm. And that's because they would not have retained liquid had they had actual liquid in them. So they made these urns specifically for cremation or to not hold liquid. So it wasn't like a repurposing of those vessels, which I thought was kind of neat too.
So they were urns with like holes in them?
Not necessarily holes, but they were just not impermeable.
Like fired to the point where they were...
Exactly. Yeah. Huh. So I thought that was neat
too. Maybe they were just garbage at making pottery.
Well, they made pottery to put everyday items in. Like they have pottery that would have been used for normal liquids and whatever.
It's a weird thing to say that the vessels that the cremations were held in could not have held liquid. Like why would that be your metric as a scientist against pottery, you know?
I think it's just they noticed it when they were doing the analysis of the different urns that they were buried in.
Those urns also weren't made to hold like Swedish fish or apples. It's just a weird thing to say, you know what I mean?
Well, not really though, because an urn is meant to hold liquid. If it's not for cremation, if it's not for burial purposes, what do you do with an urn? You put things in it.
Yeah.
Often liquid. And in this case, they noted that the urns could not have held liquid. So therefore, they were made specifically for burial purposes, which means that they clearly had a very specific burial practice going on. And it just, you're just assigning more importance to like death ritual and death stuff.
I just wonder, I didn't, you know, obviously they don't go deep into this, but I would wonder, I mean, cremations is inherently a dried good. So, yeah, could you hold other dry goods in these kinds of vessels? I'm just wondering how they know they were made specifically for burials.
Just an assumption. It's just...
Yeah.
Yeah, they just know that they couldn't have held liquid. So. Yeah.
I guess they probably have seen all the pottery from the area outside of the cemetery.
Sure.
And they would know.
So, other than that, the cemetery is overlooking the valley, and they noted that the ground that the cemetery is on is relatively infertile as compared with the surrounding area. And it also, like I said, is overlooking the valley. So it seems as though this area was chosen specifically for cemetery purposes, partly because it's a nice spot overlooking a nice area, but also because they couldn't really use that land for growing things. So it was like, well, go ahead and use it to bury people in. Why not?
I know. It's fertile now.
Right? Yeah.
Makes me wonder, too. You hear of, I guess, mass burials, but calling something a cemetery, I wonder what the organization was of this. Was there any pictures in the article? I don't remember seeing that.
Not really. There's a couple pictures of the burials themselves, but not like of the layout of the cemetery. But I think it's the constant use where they had 500 years of use by what appears to be like the same group of people.
Sure.
Or kind of the same group of people, because then, you know, the Romans came in and so there was the Roman influence going on. And then later on, and this is part of what they were looking at, is they're wanting to see what the relationship of these people was with the Romans, who kind of migrated in from the south and then left once the Roman Empire fell. And then from the north, and I think, did the Goths come from Scandinavia, maybe?
I don't know originally, but I know that they were more destructive when they came into a place, whereas the Romans were more inclusive. They like came in and set up a government and said, hey, let's be friends, but we're your rulers now.
Yeah, friends if you...
I mean, assuming it was an area they didn't have to conquer.
Yeah.
You know, they did just expand though, and that's one thing I do remember reading a lot, was that Romans absorbed cultures.
Yeah.
And integrated cultures.
Yeah.
Rather than completely destroyed cultures.
It does appear that that is what was going on here, because you see this strong Roman influence, and then the whole like wheelbark culture itself seems to kind of die out by the time the Goths were moving into that area. So maybe they were conquered at that point. It's unclear. And it was interesting too, they noted that there's weapons with the earlier burials, and then you don't see the weapons with the later on burials, as if making war and knowing how to fight were less valued in the society later on, perhaps.
Or the people buried there weren't allowed to have weapons by their overlords.
Yeah, that's possible too. Yeah. The Roman overlords, maybe. Yeah. And then they were just sitting ducks for the Goths when the Goths moved in.
Yeah.
Who knows? I don't know. But it just is an interesting large cemetery that is for a group of people that are not well studied or well known.
Right.
So, yeah. All right. Well, that was sort of an overview of the Wielbark Cemetery in Poland. And now we're going to move on to some pottery sorting and identification in the United States.
Speaking of overlords, computers are going to take over everything. That's back in a minute.
Definitely. Yeah.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to The Archaeology Show, episode 124. And I actually almost screwed up that intro because I almost said the Archaeotech podcast because I literally just interviewed one of the researchers on this next article that we're going to talk about. And the name of the article is Archaeologists Teach Computers to Sort Ancient Pottery, and it's from Heritage Daily. We'll link to that. And if we can find it, we might try to link to the article in the Journal of Archaeological Science where it was originally published. But Leszek Pawlowicz, one of the researchers at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, Arizona, is actually, I'm friends with him on Facebook. I've never actually met him, but I'm friends with him on Facebook. And so I contacted him and we did a full interview for the Archaeotech podcast. So head over to arcpodnet.com/Archaeotech if you're really interested in some of the technical aspects of what they did. We thought about interviewing him for this show, but I mean, that it really is way too technical. This is more of a general audience type of show. And we really got into the weeds on some of the computer algorithms and stuff like that over there on the Archaeotech podcast.
Yeah. So if you want to hear Chris's interview with one of the authors of the article,
right,
check out the, yeah.
Yeah. So if you're listening to this in real time as we release it, it's going to be later this week on Thursday. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't remember what episode number it is, but yeah. So check that out because it's going to be pretty cool. Anyway, Leszek is an interesting guy because, yeah, sure, he's adjunct faculty at the Department of Anthropology, but he started out, he got a degree in engineering from MIT.
Oh.
And he worked with semiconductors for like 10 years. He's done a bunch of other things and really just kind of didn't like that stuff anymore. And started, he ended up working in like computer programming for a CRM firm. And then he said, one day they asked me because they needed some help. They was like, can you walk in a straight line and see stuff? And he's like, yeah. And so he just kind of fell into CRM and he worked for that company for like 10 years.
Oh.
And now he's a professor. I don't know if he's a professor. He's in the Department of Anthropology, but I'm not sure what his pedigree is as far as anthropology degrees go. But that being said, he's an amazingly brilliant guy and, in fact, was on Jeopardy for a couple of days.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, he's really interested in basically getting computers to do things for us, for lack of a better way to say that. One of the big problems with pottery in the Southwest is that it's really hard to identify which culture and when a certain sherd was made. And that's what a piece of pottery
is
called.
Lots of different styles. Yeah, so it's hard to categorize them.
Right. And the styles are all based on the design that's painted on the pottery.
And like one researcher could call something one thing and another could call something else. So like, I think it's just sort of presented a problem for many years. Consistency in that data is
well,
a problem.
Well, and one of the first things they looked at when they were trying to teach this, use this machine learning technique to teach a computer how to recognize these different styles, was they first had to understand themselves what those styles were called.
Yeah.
And they polled many, many researchers and he was like, you know, you could ask 20 people what one sherd looked like and it was about 70% agreement.
Yeah.
60 to 70% agreement. And it was not good.
Yeah.
And he said that's one of the first problems and that's why they need some pattern recognition software out there. So they did the best they could to basically define the styles.
Yeah.
And then they started feeding this what's called a convolutional neural network, which is a program he wrote. It's a concept, but he wrote the program and they started feeding it data. And basically what it does is it looks at the image and they have to clean the image up a little bit from, you know, the background, stuff like that. But it basically looks at the image and it maps all the different points that the design takes. And then it will tell you, a percentage of confidence of what it thinks it is based on what it has. Mm. And if it's wrong, if it's flat out wrong and the researchers know it, they basically tell the computer it's wrong. They tell it what it really is. And then it itself adjusts its own model and learns next time. He said almost without fail, next time it got it right.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. But the cool thing is, and this is what we were talking about during the architect recording, was sometimes you'll get one where the computer will be like, well, it's 70% confident it's this, but it's 20% confident it could be this. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, maybe that 70-20 is a new type that we haven't been astute enough to notice. Oh, maybe it's one little thing. And it's like, we thought it was this mostly, but some of us thought it was this, but in reality, it was this whole other thing. Mm-hmm. And that, he said, yeah, that's more than likely what's going on in those cases where it's consistently a percentage like that. It's the computer is more than likely identifying a new unidentified style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, are these styles, did he get into, I know that they used Tosayan whiteware for the study, but I'm wondering how granular you get with identifying styles. Like, are you identifying a specific style to a specific person in a specific tribe, or is it like a broader range of people that use the same style? Like, how granular does that get?
He said with the right amount of data, they could almost identify the potter.
Really?
Yeah, because they're so distinct.
Wow. Yeah. That's cool.
Because the different people do things in different ways. That's just how humans work.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The styles were, you know, they followed a template, like a cultural template that they had.
Right.
Right. And you could tell, you can tell styles, I guess. I didn't really know this because we've only worked in the Southwest like once.
Yeah.
And we were floored by the pottery that we found.
But yeah.
it was just the one time. So we're by no means Southwest pottery experts, but the styles on these things sound like they were almost like the colors of kilts in Scotland, right? It was like your family, you know, like this is what we do. This is our style. So when you saw some of these sherds in another area amongst sherds that were not like it, it usually indicated trade.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So trade or, you know, theft could be anything,
you know, whatever.
Either way, it didn't start there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then also styles slightly change through time, of course, because it's like a big game of telephone. Mm-hmm. You know, you go over a few hundred years and somebody's going to do something slightly different and maybe it's going to stick. Maybe it's not. Mm-hmm. But the computer, the CNN, it's called the computer convolutional neural network. We'll figure that out.
Yeah.
And start telling you that.
I love that because, well, you definitely have had some pottery analysis. It was in the Southeast, but you've done some pottery analysis and I have done some as well. And I mean, after you see the same but minutely different shirt over and over and over again, like, I feel like human brain fatigue almost will cause you to start making mistakes or second guessing yourself or whatever. So knowing that they can teach a computer to learn the styles and then basically do an initial sort for you, I assume you would have to go back in and, like, you know, double check just to make sure. But like, to know that initial sort and identification can happen by a computer is really, really cool.
Yeah. And my thesis site in, Georgia. My thesis site in Georgia, there were several thousand sherds of pottery found.
Yeah.
And one of the types, there was a number of types. And this site dated back, it was a long time ago I did this. Something like 8,000-9,000 years. It was a really old site in Georgia. And this pottery was a style called rectilinear. Or it wasn't curvilinear or rectilinear. Anyway, it was a kind of a mixture of the two. Mm-hmm. And it was this style that we had very little evidence of in all of Georgia. Mm-hmm. And that's why when I was looking for a project for my thesis, that's why my advisor recommended this one, because he knew that this style of pottery had been found there, but nobody had really written it up or done anything with it. Yeah. So, but I'll tell you what, when I was looking at it, oh my God, like, I had a hard time telling that from, I can't remember my own thesis pottery, but I remember another one that was very similar to it called Swift Creek. Uh-huh. And Swift Creek is all over Georgia.
Yeah.
It's a lot more abundant. And it's also newer too, more recent.
Mm-hmm.
And the Swift Creek stuff, it looked really similar to what I was looking at. I'm like, are you sure this is different? But they assured me that it was, but I honestly couldn't really identify, like, how it was different, but mm-hmm. a computer, that's where they come in to play. A computer really can't tell how it's different.
Yeah, it can take the failings of the human mind, I guess you could say.
The biases of the human mind.
And take that out of the equation so that you can have data that is more consistent. But also, not only that, but in order to teach a computer to identify these different potteries, all the scientists have to come together and have a consensus on what the types are. And I think that's almost more important than teaching the computer, because otherwise scientists will never get together and be like, yes, we agree. All of this is this and this is this, you know? Like,
mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, one of the things that Leszek was saying is there have been careers built on defining certain types of pottery and writing books about them, mm-hmm. and things like that. It just starts stepping on toes when you start telling them, actually, this one's not, one's wrong. So,
yeah.
Anyway, it was really cool. One interesting thing about this is this particular program that he made can only learn one thing. That's how it works. So it's a very narrowly defined type of wear, is what he called it.
Uh-huh.
Very narrowly defined. But they're looking for other data sets to start identifying other wear types.
Uh-huh.
When he was originally doing research on this, people have used these to identify cars, dogs, boats. Yeah. I mean, you can drop anything in there.
Yeah.
And as long as you teach it, it can learn it. Mm-hmm. And I asked him if there was any limitations, and he said, not really. I mean, you know.
You just have to have the base information for it to learn from, right?
Exactly. Like, you have to actually know what you're teaching it first. And that's one of the hard things about pottery that he also mentioned is, in a lot of cases, like, you know, we don't really have a clearly defined set of rules for mm-hmm. what identifies this pottery.
Yeah.
So we're trying to feed it into a program so it can feed it right back to us and basically tell us whether we're wrong or we're right.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
I asked him how close we were as a field archaeologist. I'm asking him this question. I'm like, how close are we to having something where we can take a picture in the field, send it to your, you know, website, and then get an answer back while we're sitting there? And he actually hadn't thought of having it as a web-based application. They went straight to smartphone app.
Oh, did they?
And yeah, they're working on some stuff that's kind of plug-and-play smartphone apps, not like a bespoke, as like a proof of concept. Mm-hmm. And maybe they could get funding for a full-blown development, because your full-blown development of even a simple app, I mean, if you're not doing it yourself, you're looking at 100K easy. Mm-hmm. But doing these simple plug-and-play type apps, he said we could be weeks away.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, again, cool. It's only for that type.
Just that one type. Yeah.
We don't have a machine learning program that you can just drop anything into.
Right.
And we're probably not going to for a really long time.
Yeah.
Because it would mean that you've got all these data sets from all over the place. And really what you'd have to do is you'd have to answer a questionnaire too. Like, I don't know if the machine would be smart enough to know, oh, I'm looking at this, so I'm going to look at this algorithm mm-hmm. over here and figure out what it is. You'd probably have to answer some questions about location and some other stuff.
Got
to
give it the context, basically.
Yeah, basically give it a head start. And then it could tell you what it is within that.
Yeah.
But all that is just a slippery slope to, it's just going to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, like I mentioned the Google image search, which has been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have a database of literally everything, but what it does have is billions, if not trillions and trillions of images with labels.
Mm-hmm.
So it just makes an assumption. And I was trying to find out what the name of this picture I took at the Met Museum when we were there in New York City, because I didn't take a picture of the display plate. So I didn't know what it was. And I was trying to remember what it was, some Japanese god. And I kept trying to type in different search terms. I probably spent 20 minutes typing in terms. And then I remembered Google image search. Yeah. And I just dropped it in there. Had it in seconds.
Found it right away.
Right away.
Yeah. It's really cool what computers can do and how it can help scientists. The thing that I keep coming back to, though, is that there's got to be a consensus among scientists about what the different types are, or else it's not going to work, you know, but hopefully they can. And the other thing I read about in the article that I thought was really interesting was the way that this might be able to help put pots back together with pot reconstruction. Because if you have like a whole bunch of sherds mixed in together and it can help with that initial sorting between, you know, multiple styles, so that you can then take the ones that are all the same and potentially like reconstruct them. So I thought that was a cool little like spin-off technique basically from this program. They haven't really developed that part of it out yet, I don't think, but it's just like a thought that could be done.
I mean, the computer should be able to, if the computer can identify the style, it should know how that style goes back together.
Yeah.
And now since the computer knows what the picture looks like, well, it's all about putting a puzzle back together.
Yeah. Like, could it like give you like the, almost like a coloring book image of what it should look like? And you can just like start putting the puzzle right. pieces in. That would be so cool.
Nice.
Very neat.
We need it tied to a 3D printer so the computer can just put the pot back together and then 3D print a replica and paint it. So we have all the pieces to that puzzle.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just doing it.
And also like, why?
I mean, why not? Because yeah. so you can visualize the pot.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it'd be better to do it in VR though, to be honest, because you wouldn't have to wait for the 3D print.
Right.
So it could just put it back together, make a model of it. And then you could step into your VR construct, AKA Matrix, and view your site.
View your pottery. That would be cool.
So
future of archaeology right there. We just made it. It's happening. Yeah. Oh, the other thing I was wondering, and maybe you learned this in your interview, but would this technique work with like projectile point identification?
Exactly the question I asked him. He said the one problem with projectile point identification, like true projectile point identification, is we don't have good enough ways to take photos in the field that show the texture and the flakes and everything about a projectile point.
Yeah.
Because it's not about just the outline. Mm-hmm. He said, if you took a Clovis and a Folsom, and he mentioned one other point, and you put them next to each other and you just had the outline, could you tell the difference between the three? And you really can't.
You need the flaking pattern.
You need the flaking pattern. Because the one like hallmark of a Clovis point is this huge fluted flake right down the center of it.
Yeah.
And if you don't see that, it could easily be something else, mm-hmm. you know, because those weren't the only points that were that shape.
Right.
So you need depth. You need to be able to see the flakes in a good way, in a way that the computer can actually measure, because the computer is not just looking at it. When you say looking at it, I mean, what does that even mean? The computer doesn't look at anything. The computer measures things and it takes these numbers and these positions and it comes up with a model and it says, this is always this. I've learned that now.
So it sounds like you would need a very controlled light setting basically to bring out all of the different facets of the flakes in order to get the computer to understand what it's seeing. And
we might be able to talk to him later because they're working on a photographic technique that'll work.
Oh, cool.
Because you can do photogrammetry. There's things you can do to bring out depth and shape and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But they're not easy to use in the field.
Right.
They're convoluted. They take offline processing and it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know what I told him? I was like, I'm sitting here with an iPhone 12 Pro Max in my hand and this thing, the front sensor on the front, which when I'm looking at my phone in VR is really weird because you can see it blinking. But when I'm looking at it right now, it's not blinking.
Right.
Because that's just interesting. That face recognition camera that's on there, basically, that sensor, it picks my face up in almost no light.
Yeah.
And it's just really good at mapping the textures of my face and then unlocking my phone. And I'm like, can we just put that on the back and then use that to take pictures of other things in a three-dimensional way and really just kind of map that picture?
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
Use that technology. Yeah.
Well, and I think they're almost there because there might actually be that sensor on the back of this camera. Cause I remember when this phone came out, they had really detailed augmented reality and things like that these things are capable of now. And you really just need an app to utilize the hardware. So, cause Apple's not going to make that.
Yeah.
But if the hardware's there and it's accessible, somebody should make that so we could do those things.
Yeah, that would be really cool.
Because that's the biggest thing with giving a big data set like this. You know, here in Nevada and in a lot of places in the West, when you do pedestrian survey, unlike shovel testing or digging or excavation where you always collect artifacts because you're taking them out of their primary context.
Yeah.
When we do pedestrian survey, we're not doing that.
No.
So we don't collect anything.
Exactly.
We just leave it on the ground.
Yep.
Yeah. So we have to take the data we're going to take when we see it.
Yeah.
Because nobody's going back there.
Yep, for sure. So,
at least not for 10 years.
That's why it like makes me crazy when I see really horrible pictures of diagnostic artifacts from field crews. And I'm like, oh God, you guys, like nobody's going to see this again until another survey happens in 10 years or 20 years or whatever. And it might be gone by then. So anyway, yes.
Well, that's what's nice about digital cameras these days, because back in the day, they may not have known they were taking a crappy picture.
Yeah, true.
Because they were processing film.
That's why there's no excuse for crappy pictures these days.
It really isn't. Take
so
a good one.
There's your PSA for the day. Take good field pictures.
That's right. All right. Well, that's it. Again, if you want to check out our newsletter and see, honestly, if you listen to this podcast, some of the articles in our Monday newsletter are going to be from this show.
Yeah. Right.
So because some of our favorites are definitely going to be in there. I'm not putting more than like 3 or 4 articles in the newsletter. It's not going to really inundate you with that. But definitely check it out. Go over to arcpodnet.com, scroll up the page a little bit or scroll down, whatever your preference is, however you look at it. And then you'll see a pop-up. Don't just X that out. Drop your email address in there, and we'll show you some good things. And I'll try to let you guys know when our T Public store goes to 35% off, too, because T Public puts our stuff on sale all the time.
Yeah.
So
if you're wanting to buy some swag, just hold on a minute. There'll be a 35% off sale before you know it.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And Rachel's wearing an Archaeology Podcast Network t-shirt right now.
I sure am. It's quite soft and comfy.
Nice. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. You can also find us on the Lyceum app, a podcast app just for educational podcasts. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.